From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
CARICOM leaders discuss free trade and small states on the eve of their main meeting. What Guyana's main opposition wants from future political dialogue, and Nicaragua, Honduras and Grenada all mark tragedies of the past. I'm Debbie Ransom and this is BBC Caribbean Report. Free trade and negotiating future export deals were the order of the day as CARICOM prime ministers held a pre-conference session today in Trinidad. The main meeting of CARICOM leaders starts Tuesday. CARICOM plans to press for large countries in the hemisphere to make concessions to smaller states during negotiations towards an America's free trade area. The subcommittee of regional prime ministers met to discuss the FTAA and the successor agreement to the Lomé Trade and Aid Pact with Europe. Tony Fraser was there and filed this report.
The major concern of CARICOM, and indeed the small countries of the Central American region, is the need for concessions to be made to them in the free trade area. Prime Minister James Mitchell says, while the sub-region is fully conscious of this new era of free trade without special preferential tariffs, the large economies have to be realistic about the ability of the small states to be able to immediately compete on level terms. He says discussions around that subject preoccupy the leaders in this morning's session.
In every area, we have to look for transitional arrangements. For example, we need transitional arrangements to look after our agriculture because we can't afford the kinds of massive subsidies that other countries do and then allow them to flood our markets and even not get us into even agricultural production. You have to be careful about that.
The other major issue on the agenda of the subcommittee of prime ministers are the proposals from the regional negotiating team on the successor agreement for African, Caribbean and Pacific countries to Lomé 4. Up until broadcast time, the discussions were still proceeding on that. However, BBC Caribbean Report has been told that one concern of CARICOM is the expressed intention of the African countries to negotiate separately with Europe. I asked Prime Minister Basdeo Pandey of CARICOM's desires.
The position of CARICOM is that we wish to maintain the solidarity of ACP in our negotiations with the Europeans.
Is that a solid position in terms of the African countries wanting to negotiate separately?
Well, there's always a question of views shifting as we go along. But Trinidad's position and CARICOM's position is that we should maintain the solidarity of the group.
Tomorrow, the heads begin to deal with internal CARICOM matters. Right on the top of the list is the single market and the economy. Then there is the Caribbean Court of Justice. Chairman of CARICOM's Attorneys General, preparing for the court, Barbados's David Simmons has already said that the leaders will not sign the treaty at this meeting, but in February of next year. We have also heard that St. Lucia's Prime Minister, Dr. Kenny Anthony, will raise the internal political issue of Guyana. The intention is to have the President of Guyana and the minority leader once again sit around a table to talk about the difficulties. Tori Fraser in Port of Spain for BBC Caribbean Report.
So what will it take to get the main political parties back around the table in Guyana? Before flying to Trinidad, Kenny Anthony, CARICOM's designated prime minister, keeping an eye on Guyana's political talks, spent the weekend in Georgetown. He heard from the ruling People's Progressive Party Civic Coalition and the opposition People's National Congress. Lance Carberry is the leader of the PNC team in negotiations over the CARICOM-brokered Herdmanston Accord. He told me earlier today that the PNC had outlined to Dr. Anthony, their concerns about tighter deadlines and more focused agendas as part of the political dialogue.
The reality is that the dialogue has not been moving simply because the PVP has introduced into the dialogue some artificial constraints, like, for example, trying to make a distinction between governmental matters and party matters, which, of course, means that what you do is to render what is essentially a resolution mechanism into a very sterile mechanism. And obviously that was not the intention of the Herdmanston Accord. The Herdmanston Accord had its intention that the dialogue should be a means of resolving some of the more delicate political issues between the two parties. So once you have introduced that artificiality then it makes it difficult, because it means that whenever a matter of concern is raised, like, for example, the issue of land distribution, land and house lot distribution, which is a very sore issue and which has been on the cards for more than a year, when you raise it, you're told that, oh, you have to go and talk to the minister responsible. Now, that is really not what the dialogue was intended to be.
Well, if, as you say, the political dialogue forum has been watered down, what are your recommendations for getting it back up to the whole dialogue forum it was supposed to have been in the first place?
Well, it has to be results-oriented. It has to be results-oriented, and it has to be time-bound. In other words, you must be able to say, okay, this is the issue, these are the particular problems, let us try to resolve those problems within a time frame that is a reasonable time frame. Now, if you don't do that, what you do is convert the dialogue into a conversation. You have an extended conversation, and that's not what it was intended to be. It was intended to be a resolution mechanism.
Now, what about the two leaders coming to meet one another while you're waiting for CARICOM to look at a possible solution? What about within Guyana, Mr. Hoyt meeting with President Jagdeo?
It is, again, unlike the dialogue, the meeting of the two leaders is not intended to be just a conversation. It is intended to be a means of resolving those political issues, which it is possible for two leaders to meet and to resolve. And therefore, Mr. Hoyt has made it clear that the discussion must be on an agreed agenda. And obviously, since Mr. Jagdeo has said that he is not leader of the party, he's also said that he is not responsible for the issues agreed to under the Hartmanstone Accord. In other words, he's not responsible for the PPP's commitments under the Hartmanstone Accord.
So you're saying you could speak to him as president, but he can't give the PPP commitment?
What he has said is that he can accept those governmental responsibilities which are enshrined in the laws of Guyana. Now, really and truly, the critical issues are not enshrined in the laws of Guyana. The critical issues are the issues which form the major element of the Hartmanstone Accord for solution between the two parties.
So if he can give the commitment that he can get PPP Civic to follow his lead, then that would be fine for the PNC?
Yes, and in fact, he can do a few small things which should show an earnest of his good intentions.
Leader of the PNC team at Guyana's Political Dialogue, Lance Carberry. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. The people of Central America are remembering Hurricane Mitch, which killed more than 9,000 people a year ago this week. The storm also wreaked havoc on the economies and the environment of Honduras and Nicaragua. Orin Gordon reports on how the two countries have coped in the years since Mitch.
Where Mitch was really potent was in dumping rain, lots of it, on Honduras and Nicaragua. Poverty made it worse. Flimsy houses on eroded hillsides were, sadly, tailor-made for tragedy, once rain and the floods became a torrent. A year on, some progress has been reported in reforesting the denuded hillsides and getting people to rebuild in safer areas. But how real is the danger that poverty could force them back into unsafe areas, perhaps recreating the conditions for disaster? Malcolm Rogers of the British charity Christian Aid has written a report on the effects of Hurricane Mitch.
Many people will be faced with that situation because essentially, the most overpowering outcome and result of a large-scale natural disaster is that the poor get poorer. There is certainly a much stronger risk after natural disasters of these kinds that the poor literally will be pushed back into the tree line somewhere and will have to deplete the already fragile environment simply to provide themselves with a roof over their head.
Hurricane Mitch is estimated to have set back by 50 years Honduras and Nicaragua. The countries were given debt concessions to divert aid repayments into rebuilding them. Even though some payments were frozen until 2001, they're having to budget for it now. That money is badly needed for rebuilding, according to the Nicaraguan ambassador to London, Nora Campos de Lanquez.
That's why our budget is now more generous to be used in rebuilding the infrastructure of the country. And Nicaragua was paying 40% of the national budget in debt payments. And now we are using that money. And if we get the full 80% debt relief, we will be more free. We are planning for the budget of year 2000, to have 60% invested in social causes.
Nicaragua, for one, will be pushing for debt write-offs of up to 80%. A lot more needs to be done, like rebuilding major bridges that were swept away by the storm and which still haven't been replaced. Houses also have to be rebuilt, and people have to be resettled. Christian Aid and other charities will be throwing their full weight behind the debt relief initiative.
Orin Gordon. And in the Dutch Antilles, the rains from Hurricane Jose have stopped and the floods have receded. But now Dutch St. Martin is faced with a $1 million cleanup bill, as Mike Jarvis reports.
It was the last thing the local government of St. Martin needed at this time. An unexpected bill for millions of dollars, especially when the funds of the government are running low. But the deluge brought on by Hurricane Jose is leaving a bill which overall could be in the region of some $10 million, according to initial conservative estimates. Insurance claims alone are likely to be around $3 million. The water, power, and international phone companies are already talking of combined damages of another $3 million. And then there's the cost of cleaning up, lost business, and lost revenues to government. The local government says for its part, it does not have the cash on hand available to foot its share of the bill. So it's turning to the federal government, which owes it some $3 million, and also to the Dutch government. This situation was conveyed to the governor of the Netherlands Antilles, Jaime Saleh, and the prime minister, Susy Camille Reimer, who visited St. Martin, Sabre, and St. Eustatius over the weekend to assess the damage. They agree that St. Martin will need help to pay its way out of this unexpected natural disaster and have at least spoken about trying to help as best as they could. Governor Saleh also spoke about seeking assistance from Holland. St. Martin's Finance Commissioner Sarah Westcott-Williams and the island's Lieutenant Governor Dennis Richardson were recently in Holland prior to the hurricane and the flood and returned only marginally optimistic that Holland was amenable to relaxing the freeze it had placed on development aid for the Netherlands Antilles due to the present financial crisis gripping the federal government. The local officials are also suggesting that the freezing of aid has held up some infrastructural projects in St. Martin designed to better prepare the island to handle disasters such as what occurred last week. The Lieutenant Governor Dennis Richardson is also not ruling out the prospect of taking the federal government to court again as a last resort if monies owed to St. Martin are not forthcoming, especially now. For BBC Caribbean Report, this is Mike Jarvis in Dutch St. Martin.
And Grenada has been marking its own anniversary today. It was Thanksgiving Day, commemorating the 1983 American intervention on the island. The country's Prime Minister, Keith Mitchell, has suggested a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as Lou Smith reports from St. George's.
It was on this day 16 years ago that United States troops landed on Grenada in the early hours of the morning to bring down a revolutionary military council which had taken power 6 days earlier following the assassination of Prime Minister Maurice Bishop and others. The events of October the 19th, 1983, have left many Grenadians divided, and the fact that the bodies of those killed have not up until today been recovered and handed over to the families for a Christian burial hasn't made life any easier. A recent television interview with four of the 17 people serving life sentences for the October 19th crimes, pleading for forgiveness, showed up again a divided people. Prime Minister Mitchell believes Grenadians must open their hearts and minds and discuss all the events of the past, both positive and negative. But one notes that the country is yet to even come to terms with the events leading up to the March 13th revolution and all that happened between then and October 1983. Dr. Mitchell also believes the longer his people hold their feelings to themselves, the longer it would take for them to be at peace. In a national radio broadcast of the weekend, Dr. Mitchell urged his country folk to, in his words, recognize the vital importance of forgiveness and understanding and find new ways to release their feelings of bitterness, replacing them with love and understanding.
We need to put our past into perspective. Acknowledge that we have all had our own shortcomings and frailties. We need to discuss matters openly and without fear of generating more bitterness and hatred.
An interfaith service is the highlight of the day's Thanksgiving Day activities. Later, the American community on the island will honor the 19 Marines killed on Grenadian soil in the war for Grenada's freedom and subsequent return to the democratic system. For the BBC Caribbean Report, I am Lou Smith in St. George's.
And I'm Debbie Ransom in London, saying goodbye.